In the book of Judges, we are looking at one of the greatest times of Israel's failure. We've talked about how Israel would go through a series of cycles where they would sin, they would become involved in idolatry, they would intermarry with the foreign peoples, they would do all sorts of things and run away from the land covenant. Let me contextualize this a bit. God made promises to Israel that make it so that we would say Israel has the title deed to all the land that God has promised them. But God allows a quarantine sign to be put up. Or like last night at that Walmart where they had the police tape, and not even Walmart employees or the manager could cross that tape, even though under normal circumstances, that's where they work. That's where they're supposed to be able to exercise control. Israel is only allowed to possess as much of the land as God allows it to possess, even though it has the title deed. When Israel is in violation, in rebellion against the land covenant, Deuteronomy 28 through 30, God puts the nation under discipline. Sin would lead here to servitude, where those powers that were still within the land, that had not been entirely cleared out under Joshua's campaign, they would raise their head and they would put Israel into bondage. Usually it's certain areas of Israel at a particular time. Israel would then pray. And God had said that when Israel turned to him, when they prayed, he would deliver them. And the way that he did this was by raising up a judge who would give them deliverance. And then Judges will go on to describe the length of time, usually, that the rest was given for Israel from a particular foreign oppressor. Now, Judges occupied and worked in different parts of the countryside. Now, I've told you that the border with Egypt went to the Wadi El Arish, and that would be approximately right here. And so that would be the border right here, Wadi El Arish. I think they're probably right here where they put their designation. I don't have a detailed map, but this is probably where Wadi El Arish is, although it goes more at an angle rather than the way that they depict it. The Nile River is over here. So Israel was not, in Genesis 15, promised the land all the way to the Nile River, but they were promised it to a certain canyon, a wadi, that is called Arish, El Arish. And so the events that we're going to see are going to be within mainly the tribe of Judah, but you'll notice that there's a place called Dan. You see Dan? It's within the yellow box. You see Joppa, and then there's a tribal area called Dan. When we flew into Lod Airport, the Ben-Gurion Airport at Lod, Israel, that is in Dan. The Samson's family is from the tribe of Dan, and they lived in the tribal area of Dan. But there will be events that are going to happen also in northern Judah. So the black rectangle, all the events that we're going to look at tonight will be within that area. So this is kind of giving a picture of the larger area. And by the way, Julie, for your question, the tribal boundaries that are defined in Joshua have the tribe of Asher possessing clear into the vicinity of Sidon.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's in the book of Joshua, we don't see Israel contending for the full boundaries that God had given, because God intended for them gradually to take more and more land if they were in obedience to the land covenant. Events are going to occur within the area that was controlled by the Philistines. Now, this is part of Philistia. This is the Shephelah, a rolling area of rolling hills that's and also it includes the coastal plain. So right here we're looking at an area of coastal plain, and then pretty soon you can see that there are some rolling hills a little further away from the sea. And that area is delineated. There's a line which some of you may or may not see. This particular line here is showing the extent that can be traced of the area that was controlled by the Philistines. Most of you know that I prefer to call the Palestinians Philistines, because the word Palestine comes from Philistine. The Romans, after the second Judean revolt, decided that they didn't want to honor Israel, so they stopped calling it Israel and they started calling it after the Philistines. And that's how the whole land came to be known as Palestine. It was a denial by the Romans that the Jews had a legitimate right to the land. The Philistines basically occupied the area that's now known as the Gaza Strip. That's basically their area that they were involved in. Let's look a little further. And on this map, it's showing the areas where Samson is involved. The places that are red for the towns are ones that are specifically mentioned in association with him. You see Zora, that is, I'll start from the east and work my way westward. You see that place called Etam, E-T-A-M. It's in that circle that's the furthest to the right, and Etam is right next to Bethlehem. That's the probable location for that. It's not all that far from Jerusalem. We're going to see the chapter ending up there, chapter 15. Zora, which is in the second circle near the middle of that, is the town where Samson was born, and it's where his parents lived. Then you see Timnah. That's where the wife that he visits and so forth in this book, and you'll understand why I say visits later. Timnah is where she was from. That was under Philistine control. On the other hand, Zora was not under Philistine control, so it's they're on the border. And then further along the sea, you see Ashkelon. There also are going to be events that take place at Ashkelon. Now, Ashkelon and Gaza are within the Gaza Strip, whereas even though Philistines at various times controlled up to Ashdod, north of there, and even up to Lod and so on and so forth, their basic area, their real powerhouse, was from Ashkelon and further south along the sea.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Last week, I think you said there was two Bethlehems.
Yes.
Is that the Bethlehem where Jesus was born right
there? Yes.
Okay, so Bethlehem south of Jerusalem.
Right. When you read in the New Testament, it sometimes says Bethlehem of Judea.
Bethlehem.
Because the tribe of Judah is here. This region here is within Judah.
Okay.
And that, whereas the other Bethlehem is up in Zebulun, up north.
Thank you.
Okay, events that we're going to see are taking place in the Ayalon Valley. And that, so if this is kind of giving an idea of the terrain of Samson as he would travel, he would go through this river valley as he's going between his home in Zorah and Timnah. So just trying to give kind of an orientation. Now let's look at his hometown. As you look into this valley and you look on the left-hand side, basically under my word Zorah, that's where Zorah is. And then he's going to visit this girl that lives in Timnah, that's now known as Tel Batash. You can see here that we have a raised area. This is not a natural hill, but it is a tell. And a tell is like an onion. It has layers. What happens is buildings would be made out of stone. If there were a battle or an earthquake or things like that, the buildings would fall down and people would just keep building on top. So what happens is a lot of things that look like hills in Israel are not hills. They're as a result of buildings collapsing for various reasons and people just building on top of it. And so this would have at one time been far smaller, might have even been level land, but someone decided to occupy that site. And here we can look at some of the archaeological digs that have taken place there at Timnah. So let's look at Samson's marriage. And so in verses 1 through 3 of chapter 14, Samson argued with his parents about arranging a marriage. Marriages in that day were arranged. It wasn't that you found someone that you were interested in and that person reciprocated and two of you ended up saying, we're going to get married. The way that marriages happened was the parents made the arrangements. There was the necessity of paying a dowry and taking care of all of those legal requirements. So the parents were the ones that did it because usually the kids didn't have money to put up a dowry. So we have to understand that this would be an arranged marriage. So let's look at this. Verse 1. Now Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore, get her for me as a wife. He said, okay, Dad, I go arrange this marriage. This is who I want to marry. Now that wasn't the way that things normally happened. The father and the mother would take the initiative and they'd say, here's a nice Jewish girl for you to marry. We've made the arrangement. This will be your wife. But instead, what has happened is Samson says, okay, Dad, you follow my orders. Guess who's running the household? It was Samson. Now, isn't it interesting, though, because you remember that Manoah, that's Samson's father, when the angel of the Lord, Lord Jesus Christ himself, appeared to his wife and said that even though she had never had any children and was getting a little older, they were going to have a son, and this boy was going to be a Nazirite for his entire life. Now, normally, people only took a Nazirite vow for a couple months, but Samson was going to be under this vow for his whole life. Manoah was very concerned. He said, okay, what are we supposed to do? How does God want us to raise this boy? Do you think Manoah and his wife were very successful in training up their son?
No.
And it gets worse. So in verse 3, Then his father and mother said to him, "Is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among all my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" Now God had made prohibitions that Israel was not supposed to intermarry, because the problem that would happen is they would bring in their foreign gods. Just like we have people bringing in Islam into the United States with some terrible results. Well, they raise a good point, but do they stand up and say, "You know, Samson, seems to be a problem." Now, verse 4 tells us, though, something, and our translations may give an impression that's a little different than how I would take. Let's see, I forgot to read verse 3b, new paragraph. "Samson said to her father, 'Get her for me, for she pleases me well.'" In verse 4, we're getting a little bit of a glimpse. His parents did not know that God did overrule. He allowed Samson to marry outside of the normal bounds. And God allowed this in order to confront the Philistines. I would not say, in my understanding of the text here, my understanding of the Hebrew text, I do not understand it as God saying, "Yeah, this is just exactly what I want." But God allowed it, and the reason he allowed it was it would precipitate a problem with the Philistines. Now let's think about it. You know, we've talked about how God had said to Isaac and Rebekah, specifically to Rebekah, that she was going to have twins, and that the one through whom the lineage would be carried was going to be through the younger one. Now, Rebecca preferred Jacob, so you remember how she made arrangements to trick Isaac when Isaac was almost blind, so that he would think that he was giving the blessing to Esau, when in fact he was giving the blessing to Jacob. Was her intervention necessary?
No.
But God didn't say, "Okay, you are doing this in a way that I don't want you to do, so I'm going to forget what I said was going to happen." God carried out what he said was going to happen. When people get in there and use sin to try to accomplish what God has said will happen, well, God said such and such will happen. He allows it to happen, but it doesn't mean that he blesses the shortcut that was taken. God did want a confrontation with the Philistines. And God said, "Well, this will certainly provoke that," but God had another way in mind, I would argue. We aren't told what other way, because what Samson did precipitated the crisis. How do we know that God would have solved it? How do we know that? It's because the text tells us. Let's back up into chapter 13, starting at verse 1. "Again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. And then revelation was given to Manoah's wife that they were going to have a son. That son was going to be the deliverer. But he couldn't deliver them as an infant. He had to grow up. God was doing some long-term planning. And there was going to be a point that Israel would cry out for deliverance, and there would be Samson, and he could use him to give deliverance to the people. But if God has planned for the birth of Samson, God must have had a plan for how he would want for Samson to defeat the Philistines. Nothing tells us that Samson's plan was the way that God would have done it. If Samson had done what he was supposed to, God had another way of doing it. Remember in the book of Esther, Mordecai said to Esther that perhaps she was born for the very purpose of giving deliverance. But he said, if you don't do it, someone else will. I would argue that this passage is not saying God said, I want Samson to marry a Philistine, but God allowed it because it would precipitate the type of problem that would allow Samson to deliver. Yes?
God allows things such as, like, I know the story of Judah and Tamar.
Yes.
And Tamar is in the lineage of Jesus. So did he allow that to happen for Jesus to become?
Yeah, and actually it's interesting in that passage, Judah, as he looks at the situation, he says, Tamar was more righteous than he was. And when we were going through Ruth, we have talked about that passage.
Thank you.
But he could have done it a different way.
Yeah. He could have done it a different way.
But he, right. Yes. But he used that.
Yes.
He allowed it.
He allowed it.
Because it still made it happen.
Yeah.
But if Judah would have done what he was supposed to, it would have happened anyway.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's the point, yeah.
Verses 5 and 6, we have... Samson going down to Timnah. He wants to see this girl, and this is part of the arrangement, but there's an interesting thing that we're not told directly, but it becomes obvious. He went down separately from his parents. They did not go together, but his parents would have also gone to Timnah in order to make arrangements with her father in order that the marriage would take place. And so in verses 5 and 6, while going to Timnah, Samson killed a lion, but he told no one. So Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came to the vineyards of Timnah. Now to his surprise, a young lion came roaring against him, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat, even though he had nothing in his hand, but he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. And with kid goats, they would tend to get a hold of the hind legs and just pull them apart, and that's apparently what he did with this lion. It's pretty clear that when the Lord came on him mightily, he became more than Superman. I mean, he had strength. But if you look at this vineyard in Israel, you can see how it wouldn't be hard for a lion to hide in it. We know from the time period of this that we're probably looking at, say, April. So it's after the foliage has come onto the grapevines, and it would be an area where the lion would be able to hide. We're going to get... some chronological clues later on in our passage. So I would say it probably was around April. And so he's killed this lion and he's just left it there. Now there's a little problem. He is under a Levitical, he's under a vow, he's under a Nazarite vow for his entire life. He has just come in contact with something dead. And he was not supposed to do that. And if he did, he was supposed to go through a ritual cleansing. He didn't bother to do that either. So in verse 7, Samson talked with a woman, and this wouldn't have happened until arrangements were made. This may well have been the first time he ever talked to her. He could see her from a distance. She'd be all covered in all of her garments. He wouldn't have even seen her face, and so on and so forth. But now he gets a chance to talk to her. So in verse 7, it describes the conversation. Now he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. In verse 8 through 9, the arranged marriage has already been arranged for. So on his way to the wedding, Samson ate honey from the carcass and gave some to his parents without disclosing the source. Remember, he didn't tell anyone that he had killed the lion. No one has a clue anything about this lion. So verses 8 and 9. After some time, he returned to get her. After the arrangements had been made, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion, and behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. And behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. He took some of it in his hands and went along eating. Obviously, he didn't take any time for all the cleansing that was supposed to happen, and he would have remained unclean for many hours, even if he had done the cleansing. When he came to his father and mother, he gave some to them, and they also ate. But he did not tell them that he had taken the honey out of the carcass of the lion. Now, the whole point here is secrecy. No human except Samson knows what happened with this lion. And if anyone had come upon the lion, they wouldn't have thought that one man tore it apart with his bare hands. So no one would have thought, okay, this was something that a man did. They wouldn't think this is something Samson did. And his parents don't know the source of the honey. They don't know that they're eating something that has been ritually contaminated, and they are in violation of the law. Manoah gives indication of wanting to follow the law in his life. They have not a clue.
How did the bee swarm get into the carcass?
He's ripped it apart. He's just left it there. And they said, this looks like a good hive.
Should he even have been in a vineyard since he's a Nazarite and couldn't come in contact with grapes?
That's probably right. I hadn't thought of that. Hadn't even thought about that.
Sorry. Well, grapes would be fruit, right?
But under his Nazarite vow, he was not allowed. Chapter 13, he was not allowed to eat, to either consume grapes, nor wine, nor strong drink. Now, strong drink, when you run into it in the Bible, people tend to think hard liquor. No, strong drink in the Bible is beer. And so he wasn't allowed to either to have anything fermented, nor was he allowed to have any grape products. And so in verses 10 through 11, we have the start of a seven-day wedding feast. He didn't just go to a church on Saturday afternoon and come out a couple hours later with tin cans on the back of your car and take off. It was a little more involved for their weddings. So in verses 10 and 11, there were 30 young Philistines that attended the wedding feast. Probably his Jewish friends weren't all that interested in going down to Timnah. And so the friends here for the wedding are Philistines. So his father went down to the woman, and Samson gave a feast there, for young men used to do so. And it happened, when they saw him, that they brought 30 companions to be with him. Well, Samson is here at what probably was a drinking party, and he decides that he's going to make a wager. He's got a pretty good riddle, he figures, to give the fellows there. So in verses 12 through 14, the young men wagered with him that they could solve his riddle, so he told it to them. Then Samson said to them, "Let me pose a riddle to you. If you can correctly solve and explain it to me within the 7 days of the feast, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing. But if you cannot explain it to me, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing." And they said to him, "Pose your riddle that we may hear it." So he said to them, "Out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet." Now for 3 days they could not explain the riddle. Now if you think about it, Samson, if he loses, has to provide 30 garments. But if they lose it, each one of them only has to provide one garment. Now, we see linen and we think t-shirts. And we don't think of linen as being all that expensive. Linen is so cheap that they make t-shirts out of it. But, let's see, I forgot to show you the slide here of Rembrandt's picture of him telling the riddle. The clothing would have been worth a fortune, but let's see. I've got slides out of order. I'm sorry. Okay, now I've got some slides out of order. I don't want to go ahead and reveal what I've got next. So I will show you some pictures of linen. It was extremely expensive because before the cotton gin, it was very, very labor intensive to pull the little seeds out. I don't know if you know how a cotton gin works. It has something similar to a skill saw blade, and it's turning. And it grabs hold of the lint, but the saw blade is very narrow, and there's a very, very narrow cut that it's going through. I'll pretend that it's wide like this. So you've got the blade here in the middle. There's very little clearance, and the slot is narrower than the narrowest dimension on the cotton seed. So what ends up happening is it just tears the cotton, keeps tearing the cotton, and the seed finally drops out. Before the cotton gin was invented, it was a very time-consuming, very expensive process, lots of labor to pull the little seeds out in order that you could do anything with cotton. Therefore, cotton was expensive cloth. Highly prized, it was what rich people wore. So it's not looking here at giving these guys 30 t-shirts. He's looking at a major amount of money. These coins, by the way, are from Philistia, but from later on, from 400 to 500 BC, I haven't found any coins of the Philistines from this period of time. We'll have more to say about the coins in a moment. Well, what happens in verse 15 is that they start getting concerned because this is a lot of money for them to come up with. Now remember, it's a 7-day wedding feast, but it came to pass on the seventh day that they said to Samson's wife, and you'll notice in my notes, I have said his fiancée. And the reason for that is the marriage would not have been consummated until the seventh night of this 7-day feast. They were there just greeting all the people, but they were not yet, as we would view it, husband and wife. But the biblical term for a fiancée will include the word wife, even though they have not yet consummated the marriage. So it came to pass on the seventh day that they said to his wife or his fiancée, "Entice your husband that he may explain the riddle to us, or else we will burn you and your father's house with fire." Nice guys. "Have you invited us in order to take what is ours? Is that not so?" They said, "We thought we were just coming to a wedding, but you brought us here to steal all that we have." Well, wait a moment. Samson said, "I've got a riddle. Do you think you can solve it?" Yeah, we can solve it. Tell you what, if you solve it, I'll give you 30 changes of clothes and linen. And if I lose, I mean, if I win, then you have to give that to me. Did this woman force them into that agreement? But they're blaming her. They're saying, if you don't get this answer out of him, we're going to do you in. We're going to burn your father's house. We'll take care of you. We'll burn you too. So, you can imagine, she turned up the heat on Samson. And here's a picture of Samson. His fiancée pleaded with Samson, and he gave in on the seventh day before the end of the wager period.
John, can I?
Yes.
In my Bible, it says the fourth day on verse 15.
Okay, what they're reflecting is that, notice earlier in the passage, it said, now for in verse 14, now for 3 days they could not explain. There's an alternate reading, and they are taking it the fourth day after the third. So the fourth day after the third is the seventh, or the seventh is also the seventh.
Three plus four.
3 plus 4 equals 7, and it's a 7-day feast.
In verse 14 it says, now for 3 days they could not answer.
Notice in verse 12, he says, if you can correctly solve and explain it within the 7 days of the feast. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at is a total of 7 days, but then it mentions here, they were puzzling over it for 3 days, and then after that they started pressuring her. And so they finally got an answer from her on the seventh day, because that's the day that she got Samson to reveal it to her. So either way the text is taken, it's still on the seventh day.
So the people threatening them were basically, were they all the Philistines? So there were no people from his hometown?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's, we're looking at 12.7 miles, which takes a little while to walk. Plus, it's in Philistine country, so you'd have a lot of people that say, I'm not going there. And so he had to get wedding guests from among the Philistines, and has made this wager.
So why are the Philistines so receptive to him coming in?
That I don't know.
I never thought of that before, but it's not like they said, you can't do this.
Right. I mean, I think the father would be happy because there's a dowry being paid, and it's an unusual marriage, as we're going to find out. I mean, there are a couple of really strange things that go on in this marriage. As though the marriage has even happened. But anyway, verse 16, then Samson's wife wept on him and said, you only hate me. You do not love me. You oppose this riddle to the sons of my people, but you have not explained it to me. Notice she's saying that she really considers herself more aligned with the Philistines rather than with this one that she's going to marry. Very, very interesting.
This girl's been troubled since the beginning.
It's obviously she's smoking hot.
Well, she pleaded with him, and on the seventh day, he gave in. And he said to her, look, I have not explained it to my father or my mother, so should I explain it to you? Seems reasonable to me. I mean, I haven't told anyone, so I'm not discriminating. I mean, it's my secret. Well, it says now she had wept on him the 7 days until the while their feast lasted, and you know, there they are having to sit there and be nice to everyone as everyone's there enjoying all the beverages and everything there at their feast and so on and so forth. And Samson's saying, whoa, I wasn't bargaining on this. And it happened on the seventh day that he told her, because she pressed him so much. Then she explained the riddle to the sons of her people. In verse 18, the men told Samson the answer before the deadline, and he blamed his fiancée. Ultimately, he should blame himself. He shouldn't have been down there in the first place. And then, if he is down there, why did he tell her? But in verse 18, so the men of the city said to him on the seventh day, before the sun went down, before the deadline, what is sweeter than honey, and what is stronger than a lion? And here's a brand of honey from India called lion honey. Mm-hmm. And he said to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. I don't think we need to go into detail on that one. And so, finally it's revealed that, he killed the lion, and that's where the honey was. And you can imagine his parents were thinking, you touched a dead thing, you gave us food from out of a dead thing. I mean, Samson's in hot water with everybody, and he's not in very good mood here at this time. But he's still got his little wager to fulfill. So in verse 19, the Spirit again empowered Samson. He killed 30 people from Ashkelon, took their clothes, and returned to his father's home. So he's going to travel a distance. Let's look at Ashkelon. This is part of the wall of Ashkelon. It was a major city. Here is some of the archaeological digs there at Ashkelon from approximately the period of time. Whenever I look at archaeological things, I try to find digs that are looking at the time period that we're considering for whatever book we're in. Okay, here's where I've got the linen clothing. This is Egyptian, and that's how you can see this was fancy stuff. They'd have white linen. And on the left, you see an actual surviving piece of linen cloth from Qumran. We're looking at something that's 2,000 years old. And then you see Egyptians wearing linen. So let's look at what Samson does down in Ashkelon. Now, he's traveled a distance. Let's see, this map is not showing everything that I want. You see Ashdod right near the coast. You go further down a little bit past the lower left corner of the map, and that's where Ashkelon would be. It's about 30 miles away. My sense is that Samson wants to go far enough that people won't say, Samson did this. So, verse 19. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 of their men, took their apparel, and gave the changes of clothing to those who had explained the riddle. So his anger was aroused, and he went back up to his father's house. So he went back to Zorah. He didn't go back to Timnah. He didn't go to where his wife lived. He went to Zorah. The wedding has not yet been consummated. And now let's look at verse 20. Samson's fiancée was given to his best man by her father. He said, well, if we don't have one wedding happen, we're going to have another one. Please come up with your dowry. So, verse 20, Samson's wife, or still his fiancée, was given to his companion who had been his best man. So what has happened is the father says, it doesn't look like Samson's coming back here. So he regarded the marriage as having been annulled, okay, wasn't consummated, so I can get a second dowry. And so he gave the daughter to someone else.
He never mentions her name, correct?
No, her name is not mentioned. So now we're going to have the occasion for Philistine defeating Philistines on a larger scale in chapter 15. So here we have Samson defeated the Philistines. Now Samson, after he had cooled off, he said, okay, I'd like to go visit my wife again. So he went down to Timnah, and you'll notice it was at the time of the wheat harvest, but her father would not allow him to talk with the fiancé. 15:1. After a while, in the time of the wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. He's got a peace offering. Okay, I know things didn't go so well, but I've got a goat here. That should smooth everything over. Just what every girl wants to get is a nice goat. And so he said to the father, let me go in to my wife into her room. But her father would not permit him to go in. The reason he did not is because she has been given to another man. Now you notice it tells us after a while, a period of time has taken place, the marriage with the other man has already occurred, but this is what is called a tzedakah marriage. And you notice I wrote tzedakah as a dot under the S because it's a TS, tzedakah. A tzedakah marriage is kind of an unusual marriage, but it does happen in the Middle East. And that is a marriage where the wife lives at home and the husband comes and visits once in a while, but she doesn't live with him. She lives at her father's house, and the husband comes and visits once in a while. And that seems to be the arrangement that the other husband had. And so Samson comes, and he says, I don't see any husband, so let me talk with my wife. Father says, nothing doing. She has a tzedakah marriage with someone else, your best man. Well, Samson isn't too happy about all this. The father said, no way. And so in verse 2, her father said, I really thought that you thoroughly hated her, therefore I gave her to your companion. So he's saying, she's already married, I can't give her away again. You had your chance. Yeah, 7 days is long since passed. Because notice 15:1, after a while, there's some time that's transpired.
Yeah, my Bible was way off. He said, I'm going into my wife's room to sleep with her.
Yeah, they've added some things that the text doesn't exactly say.
So, I mean, I need to get a new Bible.
Well, they're taking the A2 there as intercourse.
Yeah. Right, yeah. So then notice how it says, is not her younger sister better than she? Please take her instead. Okay, you can pay another dowry and then you can have...
That'd be three goddamn, right?
Yeah.
This guy's like Laban.
Absolutely. So in then we have Samson gets mad. He says, okay, they're playing games with me. I mean, I'm getting played. So Samson said to them, and this is his revenge, this time I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them. Then Samson went and caught 300 foxes. He took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail, and put a torch between each pair of tails. When he had set the torches on fire, he let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines. Remember, this is at wheat harvest time, and the grain is dry, and burned up both the shocks and the standing grain, as well as the vineyards and the olive groves. Now you can imagine the SPCA and Dumb Friends League would not be very happy with Samson. So he's set on fire wheat fields all over the place, and this is an area that they grew a lot of wheat, and it's right when the wheat is nice and ready to burn. Diane, we've been through Ritzville quite a few times, so which is where this picture is. Well, you can imagine the Philistines aren't too happy about this, so they punch, and then there's a counterpunch. So lo and behold, what God wanted for there to be some strife between the Philistines and Samson is occurring. Now, it isn't happening in exactly the way that God wanted it to happen, but it is happening. Now, notice, again, he lived at Zorah. He got married in Timnah, and now he's going to be going and having all sorts of things happen. We're going to find him ultimately getting into the vicinity of Etam. So he's going to be going further east as time goes on, because he's going to try to escape the Philistines after he's really gotten things pretty hot, shall we say.
But he never married her.
Never married her. So in verse 6, then the Philistines said, "Who has done this?" And they answered, "Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion." So Samson had been loud enough in saying, "I'm going to get revenge for this," that the word gets out, that's the guy who set this fire. So the Philistines came and burned her and her father with fire. Samson said to them, "Since you would do a thing like this, I will surely take revenge on you, and after that I will cease." So he attacked them hip and thigh with a great slaughter. Then he went down and dwelt in the cleft of the rock at Etam. So he's going east, he's going to hide. He's getting out into the middle of Judah instead of being in an area controlled by the Philistines. He's wanting to get away from there. So once again, we see everything in this chapter is going to happen within that black box that's inside the yellow one. But let's look at Etam. If you can imagine, around here, it's not going to be all that hard to find a place to hide. And that's what he's wanting to do. He's got a lot of people after him. There has been a lot of archaeological work here at Etam. And so there are quite a few columbariums, which are places for burial. You have a biblical tell up in the upper left corner. And so, you know, there's just a lot of things. There are tombs, and there are caves around here. And so he figures, okay, I'm way off in Judah. I'm a long way away. No one's going to come and bother me. Well, in verses 9 and 10, the Philistines decide that, okay, it's time to attack Judah in order to get them to release Samson to them. Verse 9. Now the Philistines went up and camped in Judah and deployed themselves against Lehi, and or Lehi. That's now the area that is also called Etam. It's in this same complex. And the men of Judah said, "Why have you come up against us?" So they answered, "We have come up to arrest Samson to do to him as he has done to us." Well, in verse 11 through 14, the men of Judah turn Samson over to the Philistines. Notice, they're not thinking like a nation, are they? They think one tribe for itself. They were supposed to be thinking as a nation under God. But they're thinking individual tribe, and they say, "We don't want any problem with the Philistines, so let's hand over Samson," verses 11 through 14. Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Etam. Okay, this is the cleft of the rock at Beit Lehi, also known as Etam. And here's another picture of it without having all the growth there. And so they went, they found where Samson is hiding. They bring 3,000. They say, this is a pretty bad dude. We've got to be reinforced in order to deal with him. They went down to the cleft of the rock of Etam and said to Samson, do you not know that the Philistines rule over us? What is this that you've done to us? You've made life worse for us. Isn't that what the Israelites said to Moses? Mm-hmm. Not, hey, you know, God's using you to deliver us. We might have to put up with some heat for a while, but it's, look at what you've done to us. You've stirred up our enemies. You know, it's sort of like some of the things we hear in response to getting tough with North Korea. Oh, wow, we're going to make them mad. Seems like they're already crazy mad. So, in verse 11b, and he said to them, as they did to me, so I have done to them. But they said to him, we have come down to arrest you, that we may deliver you into the hand of the Philistines. Then Samson said to them, swear to me that you will not kill me yourself. I mean, that would be the easy way. Do him in, and that way they can bring a corpse to the Philistines. So they spoke to him, saying, no, but we will tie you securely and deliver you into their hand, but we will surely not kill you. And they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. When he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. Then the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the ropes that were on his arms became like flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds broke loose from his hands. Then in verses 15 through 17, with the Spirit of the Lord having come upon him mightily, he killed 1,000 Philistines with a donkey jawbone. In case you're wondering what a donkey jawbone looks like, it's like that. And you would grab a hold of it near the front teeth, in that area between the front teeth and the molars. And you can see the depiction of the statue done by an Italian artist. Verses 15 through 17. He found a fresh jawbone. He didn't want an old one because an old one would be brittle. So he's got one that's fairly fresh. Once again, probably a dead animal that he may have killed. And once again, we have this guy that is really taking seriously his Nazarite vow. So he found a fresh bone of a donkey, reached out with his hand and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. Then Samson said, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, and the jawbone of a donkey, I have slain 1,000 men. And so it was when he had finished speaking that he threw the jawbone from his hand and called the place Ramoth Lehi, that is jawbone height. How would you like to live on jawbone height? Well, now he's going to receive a deliverance from the Lord. The Lord provided water for Samson. So in verse 18, then he became very thirsty, so he cried out to the Lord. And all through the book of Judges, God is faithful even to unfaithful people when they call out to him for help. He said, you have given me this great deliverance by the hand of your servant. And now shall I die of thirst or fall into the hand of the uncircumcised? So God split the hollow place that is in Lehi, and water came out, and he drank. The Spirit returned, and he revived. Therefore he called its name En, which is spring, En Hakkore, literally spring of the caller, spring of the one who calls. The one who has called upon the name of the Lord has received deliverance. God doesn't, by the way, promise to give eternal life to the person who calls on him. But when you look at Romans 10, which is citing Joel chapter 2, deliverance for believers comes when we call upon him. The Romans 10 passage is saying that it is believers who call upon him to receive temporal deliverance, deliverance in this life. But eternal life, everywhere in Scripture, including in Romans 10, occurs by simple faith alone in Jesus Christ alone. So, verse 20 tells us, he judged Israel for 20 years. He judged Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistines. Now, when I look at Samson, I've said before, the Bible pictures even people that would be regarded as heroes as having all their faults. God keeps his word. But how much better off would Israel have been if they had obeyed the Lord and had not gone into rebellion? How much better off would Samson have been? But you know, if we look at this from another standpoint, Samson's bad experience with this wife and later on with Delilah pictures something like the suffering that God went through with Israel. Israel was regarded as God's wife. Israel was always unfaithful, going out and chasing after foreign gods. God was still bound by his covenantal loyalty to Israel despite all of its failures. I am pleased to say that as I go through the text, whether I'm in Old Testament, whether I'm in New Testament, I see all the way through God's faithfulness to what he has promised, despite man's unfaithfulness. You know, we look at our own lives, and, okay, we may say, well, you know, I'm better than so-and-so. But, you know, when God looks, he's saying, no, we're all pretty miserable. But when God makes promises, he keeps them. He guarantees everlasting life to the person who believes Jesus Christ for the promise of everlasting life. He promises to discipline us when we get sideways with him. He promises rewards for those that are faithful to the end. But God remains faithful to what he has promised. Samson isn't someone I'd recommend emulating. But we learn things about God by looking at Israel, even at times of Israel's failure. And we learn from Israel's leaders, even in their times of failures, because we find out about the type of God that we have. I forgot to show you a couple more slides that I have, so I'll do that. This is called Samson Spring at Beit Lehi, and then there we have the sin cycles. Israel, all the way through the book of Judges, keeps going through this cycle. They sin. As a result, they come into servitude under a Gentile nation. They pray. God delivers them. Samson prayed. God delivered him. And then there's deliverance that comes as a result of the prayer. And then there's a period of rest. How much better off Samson would be, and how much better off Israel would be if they had obeyed and gone about things God's way. But even when they didn't, God did not forget what he had promised. Any questions?
Yes. I go back last week, chapter 13, verse 3. You described the angel of the Lord as possibly being Jesus. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed my notes when we were back looking at chapter 15 of Genesis, and then we were looking at 15:18. In chapter 16, Sarah meets with the angel of the Lord. Is that also Jesus?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Let me look. Jesus is the only one that reveals himself to people. He's the revealed member of the Trinity. But looking at Genesis 15, proof that there are a number of passages where we see the angel of the Lord, that if we track through the context, we find evidence that it is the Lord himself, and Jesus would be the one that is the revealed member. But you'll notice in chapter 16 of Genesis, we have the angel of the Lord speaking on several occasions. He speaks in verse 8, introduced in verse 7, speaks in verse 9, speaks in verse 11, verse 10, verse 11. But it's very interesting, verse 13. Then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her. And I've explained this before. When you see L-O-R-D, but you see all the letters capitalized, okay, I'll do it here. Okay, when you see Lord that looks like this in your Bibles, but it's a slightly smaller font size, not quite that small in relation. But when you see that, that is an indication that the Hebrew word that is there is Yahweh. It's not another word for Lord. It's not Adonai. The word that is there in the text is Yahweh. So it is important when you're looking at your Old Testament to differentiate that. What in the world? Okay. To differentiate Lord when it has all caps as opposed to when it has an initial cap. That if it's lowercase letters for O, R, and D, then it's a word other than Yahweh. Sometimes people have pronounced it Jehovah, but that would not be a correct pronunciation. If you see capital L, lowercase ORD, then it's one of the other words for Lord. But every time you see it all in caps, then it is a reference to Yahweh. And so she spoke to Yahweh who had spoken to her. So it's a clear identification. The angel of the Lord equals the Lord.
So, and those Lord spellings are contrasted in Genesis chapter 18, verses 1 and verses 3.
Yes. Yes. And so the word Adonai can be used of either humans or of God, but the word Yahweh is only used of God. So you have to ask when you're reading, if it isn't all uppercase letters, is it saying Sir, Lord in that sense, or is it saying the Lord? And with the other words like Adonai, it's something that context has to tell you which it is. But if you see Yahweh, there's no choice. Yahweh is always God.
Thank you. I had a question.
Yes.
Now, last week you touched a little bit on Melchizedek, and we studied a little bit about it in our Bible study. But now that I know that my Bible is kind of off, and I need to get a new one. So Melchizedek was one of a small group of God-honoring people throughout the Old Testament who came in contact with the Jews who were not Jews themselves. This indicates that the requirement to be a follower of God is not genetic, but based on faithfully obeying his teachings and recognizing his greatness. So early on, I've heard before that the Old Testament was for the Jewish people and the New Testament is for Christians. But this is telling me that even in the Old Testament, all the requirements was to believe in God, one God. Is that correct?
Okay, yes. Let me nuance it a little bit. The issue of the blessing of eternal life is expressed to be available for the whole world. Genesis 12:3, Abram was told, in you, and clarified later in Genesis 22, in your lineage, or 21 rather, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So what God did would be like Israel's a funnel. Now, there's a problem if you try to fill a funnel with water, isn't there? What's the problem if you try to fill a funnel with water? It runs out the bottom. Israel was not supposed to be a bowl. Israel was supposed to be a funnel. So that God would bless them, and through that, blessing would come to the rest of the world. God chose them as the instrument through whom he would work. The Old Testament is tracing the lineage of the Messiah who is yet to come. So Israel was supposed to be the channel of blessing for the whole world, specifically by the Messiah coming through Israel. But it was never intended as a bowl that God said, I'm blessing you and I don't want the rest of the world blessed. At this time, church age, God is working through a different agency, the church, which is comprised of all believers of any ethnicity, and they are the ones who are supposed to reach the world. There is going to be a time in the millennial kingdom where he is going to again focus his attention upon reaching the world through Israel. But right now he's doing it in a different way, and the text sets that forth, that God intended to deal with the world in different ways at different times.